Brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, assalamu alaikum, peace be on all of you. My goodness, when Lenin said that there were decades when nothing happens, but weeks when decades happen, he had this year in mind. Cast your mind back. Just 14 months ago, myself and my comrade Ron Mackay, on our re-emergence from besieged Gaza, where we had once again broken the illegal siege on the people there, we were arrested by the goons of somebody you may remember called Hosni Mubarak. They bundled us into a van and sped towards the airport, where they confined us, even following us to the restroom, as you folks oddly describe it. We got no rest from them. And at the door of the aircraft, out stepped a factotum from the foreign ministry of Mubarak's regime and declared that I was henceforth persona non grata, which means a person without status, that I was being deported from Egypt, and that I would not be allowed to return ever. He added, ever. I told the man, I felt a little guilty afterwards because he was only the messenger. I said, the day will come when the real persona non grata in Egypt is the gangster for whom you work, Hosni Mubarak, who will, if he's lucky, flee the country with his billions, leaving people like you to face the music, face the wrath of the Egyptian people, the great people of the greatest of all Arab countries. He looked a little shamefaced, I like to think, but he was, as they said on another occasion, merely doing his duty. And so it seemed. I was banned from Egypt forever. But of course, the day came even quicker than the most optimistic of us could have expected, when this regime was swept away, when Mubarak's assets were frozen, having been counted at the last count at more than $80 billion. It's not a bad salary for President of the Republic of Egypt for 30 years. Of course, the banks who froze his assets were happy to bank his assets until a few weeks before. And the governments that belatedly clucked about his tyranny, bankrolled and buttressed and armed and supported in every way that dictatorship almost until the final hours of it. So things change fast when they begin to change. Cast your mind back. The same 14 months, I was banned from Canada.
Forever.
Forever. I was banned from Kennedy, from Jason Kenney, forever. Now Jason Kenney seems to be in a bit of trouble. I mention it not to take what the Germans call Schadenfreude, pleasure in the discomfiture of others, but merely to make the point that all things must pass, all tyrants must pass, and let's hope Jason Kenney passes very soon indeed. And yesterday and the day before, I was in Calgary, which is the constituency of the said Jason Kenney, where people turn out in their hundreds, many hundreds, to to hear me speak. And where we launched on Saturday night, Viva Palestina Canada, which will soon become a national organization, but will forever will forever be linked with Jason Kenney's backyard. You may think I'm rubbing it in, but that's the sort of guy I am. And I can tell you today that the finest lawyers in Canada have begun my legal action against Jason Kenney and his factotum. We will sue them for millions of dollars. And every cent that we get will be spent here in Canada building an even stronger anti-war movement than we already have here. It's bliss for someone like me to be alive this year of revolutions. For 35 years or more, I have worked, dreamed, prayed, beseeched the Arab masses from the Atlantic Ocean to the Persian Gulf, from Morocco to Bahrain, to rise up and overthrow the dictatorships placed upon them and kept upon them mainly by Western countries. Because I believed that the Arabs would never fulfill the enormous potential that they have, which is mind-boggling. Think of that landmass from Morocco to Bahrain, all that sea, all that ocean, the ocean of petrol and gas, 350 million people speaking one language. In the European Union, we speak 300. In the Arab lands, one language, more or less, one religion, one God, one culture. This is a potential superpower which ought to be vital in every international arena and issue, but which is instead a basket case of ineffectual, pathetic inability to even put bread on the table of the people of their countries. And there are some things which surprise even me. I learned just in the last couple of weeks that Yemen is the poorest country in the world. How can that be? How can an Arab Muslim country next door to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, how could that country be the poorest country in the world? What kind of Islam, what kind of Arabism is that? It is indeed a shame. In Egypt, half of the people, that's 40 million people, therefore, 40 million. What's the population of Canada? 25? 25 million of you, 40 million Egyptians are living on less than $2 a day, not knowing if there's food tomorrow, if there's shelter tomorrow. This has been the reality for so many Arab countries. But as those conscious of nuclear physics will know, when a critical mass has been achieved, a chain reaction, a nuclear explosion, will follow. And that critical mass turned out to have been achieved when a young man in Tunisia, of all places, set fire to himself in an act of self-immolation, which turned out to be the spark which burned down the dictatorships of the Arab world. His name, Abu Aziza, will live forever. And the pioneering way in which the Tunisian people brought down their tyrant in what was, even by Arab world standards, one of the grimmest police states in the region. The way in which they were not fooled that just by the president running away, that meant that their job was done. Who returned in their hundreds of thousands again and again and again to the streets and the squares of Tunisia until one by one by one the ministers of the previous dictatorship fell on their swords and left the public stage. And last week, the RCD, the dictatorship party of Tunisia, was dissolved by decision of the High Court of Tunisia. Once it was all powerful, only months, less than 3 months ago, less than 12 weeks ago, it was all powerful, and now it no longer exists. This is what democracy looks like. And of course, this democratic spring spread to the greatest of all the Arab countries. And again, the Egyptian masses in their millions, they struggled might and main until this 30-year pharaoh, phony, fake, tin pot pharaoh, was removed from the scene, fleeing with his ill-gotten gains to we know not where. Maybe Israel. After all he did for them, it's probably the least they could do for him. But his assets now frozen, the police seeking to interview him about how he and his family garnered this extraordinary wealth. The son, Gamal, who until 9 weeks ago was a shoe-in, a cert to be the next president of Egypt, giving us another 30 or 40 years of Mubarak dynasty, will be lucky to escape imprisonment or worse at the hands of the Egyptian people. And very soon, the so-called National Democratic Party, which is neither national nor democratic nor a party, the rubber stamp of the Mubarak years, will itself face the fate of the RCD in Tunisia. But again, there were many who tried to manage this Egyptian revolution, to say, well, the president has gone, long live the vice president. The vice president was the torturer in chief of the Mubarak dictatorship. Omar Suleiman, the jailer of the Palestinian people in Gaza, the divider of the Palestinian national movement, and the torturer of the people of Egypt. But the people came back to Tahrir Square, to the avenues of Alexandria, to Suez, even to Al Arish, a place I know well. Every town and city and region in Egypt came back over and over again until one by one the ministers of the dictatorship were swept away. Omar Suleiman, the interior minister, now on trial for torture and corruption. The prime minister, Ahmed Shafiq, appointed in the last few days by Mubarak, trying to cling on, now swept away. The military junta, whom the West hoped might be able to hold the ring so that they could emerge with something from this revolutionary upheaval, have been confounded. Let me say this, and I say it with certainty and conviction. No future government of Egypt ever again will play the role of Israel's jailer of the Palestinian people. The siege on Gaza is finished. Hallelujah. The gates are open. And even if not declared, because this is an interregnum, when a democratic government comes to power in Egypt, it will be declared all right. And I say to the supporters of Israel in the room, it's time to listen carefully. Your days of murdering, torturing, jailing, occupying, starving, dispersing the Palestinian people are almost over. And it's time for you to listen very carefully indeed. The siege, whether declared or not, is finished. The role of the Egyptians in dividing the Palestinian national movement is finished. And when sometime in the future, I refer not to the farcical so-called peace process that is now dying in the sands of the Middle East, having been on life support for many, many long years. Endless process, no peace, because no justice. No justice, no peace, however elaborate your process. But one day, this matter will return to the international agenda, and one day there will be negotiations again. But from now on, the Palestinians will be immeasurably strengthened by an Arab world that is now Arab, by an Islamic Arab world which now regards itself with self-respect and demands the respect of others. So everything just changed utterly. The Arab regimes that were collaborating with Israel, leaving the Palestinians alone to face all of these crimes. Now there is one Arab people from the Atlantic to the Gulf, and all is changed utterly. Of course, the revolution isn't over, either in Tunisia or Egypt. It's certainly not over in Yemen, where the president has been in for 33 years. 30 for Mubarak, 33 for Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president of Yemen. But his days are coming to an end, as the vast majority of Yemenis in the poorest country in the world decide that enough is enough. It's certainly not over in Bahrain, where the Prime Minister, I'm not making this up, the Prime Minister of Bahrain has been the Prime Minister since 1961. That's before the Beatles. Before the Beatles, who've been wound up for 40 years, this man has been the Prime Minister. Eat your heart out, Gaddafi. 1961 to 2011. Of course, it helps that he's the uncle of the king. And the king has been in power, or his family have, absolute power, for 231 years. Now that's a long time. But the masses are moving so decisively in Bahrain that this day, the unfreest country on the earth, Saudi Arabia, dispatched thousands of soldiers and a long armored column of military armor, tanks, and other weaponized transport across the causeway in a show of support, the news said, for the beleaguered Bahraini royal family. What a gruesome twosome. The court corrupts like kings of Arabia, clinging together in their last days. And what happened today on that causeway? Remember that you heard it here. Saudi Arabia just lit a touch paper which will set a fire in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, which happens to be highly combustible, where all of the oil and gas is. And this interference, this invasion, that's what it is, this invasion and occupation of Bahrain will be the beginning of the end of Al Saud, as well as the beginning of the end of the Bahrainis. It's certainly not finished in Libya, where Gaddafi, the brute Gaddafi, and his son, looking like a high-end drug dealer off HBO's The Wire. Didn't they notice the resemblance? Stringer Bell, Saif al-Islam, they could have been played by the same man. The Gaddafi family business, for that's what it is. 42 years in a country now of 6 million, before of 2 million, 3 million, with an ocean of gas and oil. Every Libyan should be a multi-millionaire. The public realm in Libya should be like Beverly Hills, the hospitals, the schools, everywhere, the streets, the lights, everything should be of the highest order. And anyone who's ever been to Libya walks around with their mouth open, asking themselves at least, where did all the money go? Well, a lot of it went into the pockets of the Gaddafi family and clique. 8 sons, all of them billionaires, do the maths. And of course, a lot of it went on purchasing the loyalty of foreign mercenaries now being ruthlessly deployed to crush the freedom movement in Libya. The West is now plunged into chaos. They don't know which dictators to back and which dictators to sack. Total, absolute chaos. And worse from their point of view, they decided, having backed Gaddafi, now to sack him just before he appeared to win the war. So Gaddafi is now back, whilst the West tried to get rid of him. What's going to happen now? What's the relationship going to be now? Is there going to be two Libyas? Is there going to be any so-called no-fly zones, which of course are meaningless but give the impression of doing something? It's too late. The dictatorship of Gaddafi has won for now, but the people will be back, because the burning desire for freedom, you know, it used to be claimed, friends of Israel used to say, Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East. Well, that depended which end of the telescope you were looking through, of course. If you were an Israeli Jewish citizen, yes, you had a perfect democracy. If you were an Israeli Arab citizen, you had rather less perfect democracy. If you were one of the millions of Palestinians militarily occupied for 44 years, you had no democracy at all. And if you were one of the millions of Palestinian refugees driven from their homes and living out miserable lives as refugees in neighboring countries and further beyond, you had no democracy of any kind. But insofar as Israel was a democracy, we didn't realize, most of us, that that depended on the Arabs being forced to live under dictatorship so that that claim could be made. Israel opposed each and every one of these Arab revolutions for the reasons or the obverse of the reasons I earlier adumbrated. They are terrified of Arab democracy because an Arab democratic government will never forget Jerusalem, will never forget Palestine. There are other countries, not yet moving, but as one domino after another falls, it is bliss to be alive in this year of revolutions, 2011. And Jason Kenney, it won't be complete until you're out of office too. Wassalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
Inspiring words. Before we get to the question and answer period, I just had a couple of announcements I wanted to share with you. And this is the cue or the signal for the marshals with the buckets to get into place. The first announcement is quite an exciting announcement. It is an event that's going to be happening in Lebanon, in Beirut, in the summer, the third week of July. And it is George Galloway Summer University of Palestine, which is the second time that it's happened. And we're hoping to build a large contingent of activists from across Canada to go and to participate in that event this summer. So I want to draw your attention to the tables inside the lobby at the end of the event and make sure that you pick up leaflets so you can find out how you can get involved and be part of the mobilization of activists right across Canada to participate in the Summer University of Palestine. You can imagine what an amazing event this is going to be this summer in the wake of the revolutions that are underway across the region right now. The second announcement is an appeal for support from all of you. As you know, this event has been organized by the Toronto Coalition to Stop the War, and for every single event or struggle that's underway, we have been part of those mobilizations. We organized this event on very short notice because, of course, we wanted to make sure that we had an audience here for Mr. Galloway and a chance to discuss and exchange. So there will be people circulating through the crowd tonight with buckets, and we're going to ask you, if you can, to make a donation to however you can to help us carry on with the work we do. We have one large mobilization coming up on April 9th. It's a rally to end the war and occupation of Afghanistan and to bring home the troops, the Canadian troops from Afghanistan. So if you can make a donation, we encourage you to be generous. The buckets will be passing through out the question and answer period. So thank you for coming and for being very generous. Bye-bye.
Great. Thank you so much, everyone. We're going to have a question and answer period now. So I'm going to put their hands up really high. I'm going to take three questions at a time, and I'm going to observe gender parity. And then Mr. Galloway is going to respond, and then we'll take another group. So, yes, sir, in the striped shirt. So if you, what I'll do is I'll choose you, and then...
A young woman appears oblivious to the fact that I was Britain's leading opponent of the Iran-Iraq war. I was on Iran's side in the Iran-Iraq war. You don't have to believe me. It's a matter of public record, in the parliamentary record and in the public prints. There was no YouTube then between 1980 and 1988, but there was Hansard, which is the parliamentary record. Not only was I aware of Halabja when it was being used as an excuse to kill a million Iraqis by Britain and the United States, I was aware of it at the time and was the only Labour Member of Parliament to speak at the first demonstration condemning the use of chemical weapons against the people in Halabja. I just didn't believe that we should starve to death an Iraqi child every 6 minutes of every day and night through sanctions to punish them for having a dictatorship which they didn't elect and couldn't remove, and which in any case we had put into power and armed and financed and supported down all the decades. And equally, I'm not a supporter, as I wasn't a supporter of Saddam Hussein, neither am I a supporter of President Ahmadinejad in Iran. I just don't want the West to make a war against Iran. I don't want the West to bomb your country. I believe that your country has a right to nuclear energy. Indeed, when the tyrant Shah, I don't know if you agree with that appellation, but to me he was the biggest tyrant of them all. When the tyrant Shah, you can't applaud that point, I see. How revealing. The tyrant Shah, America begged him to build nuclear power plants using their technology throughout the 1970s. I don't believe that Iran should be sanctioned and threatened for having no nuclear weapons, while Israel can build a mountain of hundreds of nuclear weapons. That's the difference between you and me. The regime in Tehran will be removed or kept according to the masses in Iran. No government is supporting them in the world. There is no power keeping Ahmadinejad in office. He has enemies all over the world, as we have seen this evening. I don't know why you're pursuing me. Pursue him. Pursue him. I don't know why you want me to answer for the regime of Ahmadinejad. Now, the point that was made first about Bahrain, please, you had two out of the three questions, and I've dealt with your questions. Please allow the rest of us to have a meeting about the Arab revolutions, which is what we came here to have. In Bahrain, the young man is anxious about Bahrain being the first of the Arab revolution in the GCC area. But of course, if Bahrain succeeds in having a revolution, it might be the first, but it will not be the last. Because if the 231-year royal dictatorship in Bahrain is swept away, the other dictatorships in the GCC area will also be swept away. This whole process of knocking away pillar after pillar. Now, there are some people trying to play sectarian cards, not the young man, of course. There are some people who say this is a Shiite revolution in Bahrain. Well, it's true that the Shiites are the big majority, as a matter of fact, of the population in Bahrain, whilst having no political power at all. But that doesn't concern me at all. I'm not interested in whether somebody is a Shiite or a Sunni or a Christian or a Jew. I'm interested in bringing down the dictatorship in Bahrain, which suppresses all the people, all of them, Sunni and Shia, in the country.
Arab countries really should have, as their president, have come to an end.
Chose, and that they can remove that president when they no longer wish to have him or her in charge. That's what we ask for ourselves. Indeed, we would accept nothing less. Why should Arabs be any different to us? It was oftentimes said that Arabs were unsuitable for democracy, that Islam was hostile to democracy. Even some Islamic extremists argued that voting was haram, democracy was forbidden, and all of this rubbish. It's all been washed up by the events of the last 3 months. In fact, another person who's been washed up by these tides of history is bin Laden and Zawahiri and all these other Salafist haters of democracy who believe that by substituting themselves for the mass of the people, by exploding themselves and other people, they could free their people, when all along the answer to the dictatorships in the Arab world was there on the streets, in the houses, in the workplaces, in the students, in the universities of their people. Once people move, and this is the example of Iran. You see, the tyrant Shah was all powerful. His SAVAK security apparatus, absolutely terrifying and fearsome. But when the Iranian people moved in their millions upon millions, no dictatorship can stand up against it. The soldiers cannot shoot millions. And they only have 6 or 12 or 18 bullets in their magazine. If they kill 12 or 18, they'll be torn to pieces by the other millions that they didn't manage to shoot. So there comes a point in this building of this critical mass where the dictators fall. And that will happen in other Arab countries too. The fear that exists in the West about Islamic government coming to power in Egypt, say, or Tunisia, is completely misplaced. First of all, the powerful and popular Islamic parties in Tunisia and Egypt are not the Taliban. They're not Al-Qaeda. They are a government, or would be a government, comparable to the government of Erdogan in Turkey, which I happen to believe is the best government in any Muslim country. And if all the Muslim countries had a government like that, it would be a big step forward. And I believe, as a prediction, that that's what will happen. That the president of Egypt will not be from the Muslim Brotherhood, because they've already announced that they will not stand for that position. But the Muslim Brotherhood is the most popular and powerful political force in Egypt. What's wrong with that? Egypt is an overwhelmingly Muslim country. What's wrong with them choosing democratically a Muslim government? It's our job to deal with whomsoever the people of Egypt or Tunisia choose. And that's what I hope that we will do. There's some very fertile thinking going on. In Tunisia, for example, the leader of the Islamic movement, Sheikh Rashid Ghannouchi, spent a long, long time in exile in London. We learned much from him. And he is proselytizing in Tunisia now, having returned to the country, for a red-green alliance of Labour and the left and the Muslims coming together as a powerful political force which can stabilize the new democracy in Tunisia. And I personally wish it all the best. Capitalism ineluctably leads to injustice and war. I have believed this all of my life, but I can't wait or ask others to wait for the overthrow of capitalism. Well, go on and bring them down. I don't know why you're shouting at me. Go on then. You really are winning friends and influencing people, I must say. Let me give you a tip as someone who's been a long time in politics. You're making enemies of all the people in this room. And that's not a good idea. It's really not a good idea. Go and pursue Ahmadinejad. Many of the people in here will go with you. But don't destroy their meeting because of your selfish preoccupation with your own issue, which I've already dealt with in two long interventions. It's just a tip, just a bit of advice. What we can't do is wait until we have a resource-based economy before bringing down dictatorships or fighting against war and for peace. These are linked. but they are not the same thing. And so, whilst I'm happy to look at your documentary, I don't think it's key in any way to these big struggles that we face today. Certainly, Britain and America, in particular, with their dependence on finance capital. I don't know if you've seen the movie that won an Oscar a couple of weeks ago called An Inside Job, narrated by Matt Damon, which is an absolutely fantastic movie, if you haven't seen it. I'm sure it's not as good as your documentary, but An Inside Job, it's very, very good. And Capitalism, A Love Affair, with Michael Moore. These are things that we must study, but they're not the same thing as the issue that we are discussing tonight. And with respect to the sister who talked about Wisconsin, and of course I am wholeheartedly behind the labor unions in Wisconsin, we really cannot compare the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak with the governor of Wisconsin. We really can't, and we do an injustice actually to the Egyptian people by implying that these are the same things. The labor rights of the public sector workers in Wisconsin were hard fought, hard won, have been hard lost, but one day will be won again. But in the United States, there is freedom to organize and to vote. It's not used very well, and it's distorted and perverted by money and by many other things. But it's not the same thing as the dictatorships that we are talking about tonight. However, I can tell you this. On Wednesday morning, I begin a weekly radio show on Radio WBAI in New York in the tri-state area every Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, right after Democracy Now! I hope it will be syndicated throughout the land and here in Canada in time also. And these issues of labor rights and human rights and economic rights and political rights for the peoples of North America will feature very highly on the kind of issues that I'll be discussing on that radio show. Thank you.
Opposing intervention by governments from the West, and I'm reluctant to, you know, get into that kind of thing, but the rebels themselves are asking for it. And it seems, and they have predicted that Gaddafi will kill about 500,000 people, because the people who are in the east part of the country have said they are not going to go down without a fight. So it's not going to be a case of 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 leaders being killed. It's going to be a lot of ordinary people on the street who have supported this revolution. So what do we do?
Thank you very much.
Was standing on the street and has been there since February 14th. And now the Saudi forces are entering in Bahrain and they are trying to crush the movement over there. Similarly, if the same thing happens in Benghazi and Gaddafi with all his evil forces comes and crushes the people over there, then as you said that the critical mass has already been achieved over there in this revolutionary period, what we are seeing in the year 2011. So after, God forbid, if crushing the people in Bahrain and in Benghazi, so will that be sending a message to all over the people who are willing in the GCC and other Arab areas, that will it be sending a negative message to them? And secondly, before the tsunami in Japan, all the UN and the European Union, they were having their meeting for a no-fly zone, but this catastrophe in Japan, it is a catastrophe, and we are feeling sympathy for the Japanese people and all the damage created over there. But right now, after that tsunami, all the attention of the media and the people have been diverted towards Japan. And that no-fly zone and all the Arab League's consent about the no-fly zone all have gone in the backyard. So if this no-fly zone hasn't been imposed, then my sister said that Gaddafi will be coming over there. So we being the peace-loving people in all over the world will be watching this massacre over there. And what can we do? So are we going to watch this as a swift phenomenon, or we can do something?
Thank you very much. And sir,
to some extent to the young man from
Harvard. Confidence in yourself. You know, the idea that in the Gulf the people are too stupid to have democracy, too concerned about other things. I mean, how stupid do you have to be a democracy? Is the United States, Canada, Britain, are the people in these countries endlessly thinking about discussing the way that they want their country to be run? No, they vote every now and again and then go back to the television. Arabs are no different to anybody else in that regard. And it's simply not true that the youth in Egypt are better educated than they are in Saudi Arabia. In fact, the opposite is the truth. Saudi Arabia has more graduates than any other Arab country. And by the way, 60% of all Saudi Arabian graduates are women. So it's simply not true that the Saudi people are too stupid or preoccupied by trivial things to achieve democracy. And you really must have more confidence in yourselves. Not to think that if you get rid of a dictatorship that's been there 230 years, you might alienate yourself from other dictatorships. To hang with all the dictatorships, show the way, lead the way, light the path. That's what the spirit should be. The young woman who spent 30 years opposing foreign intervention in what they call third world countries, you really should make it 31, sister. There are many reasons why we must oppose Western governments and armies getting involved in fighting in yet another Arab and Muslim country. There are many, many reasons why we must oppose that. I did an interview in The Guardian last Saturday. You can look it up, guardian.co.uk, a debate with a Conservative MP on this very subject, in which I said the best way to come to the aid of the Libyan revolution is for Egypt and Tunisia to open their borders and for Arab volunteers to flood in their hundreds of thousands into Libya and to take up the side of the Libyan revolutionaries. Somebody said, well, they won't be trained. Well, the Arabs who went to Afghanistan in the 1980s, most of them had never been involved in a war before. But as the former Soviet Union would tell you, they proved quite a formidable fighting force. The only people who have a right to intervene in the Libyan revolution are the Arab masses. That's the long and the short of it. And don't be seduced by this talk of a no-fly zone. First of all, Gaddafi winning or not winning the war does not depend upon air power. In fact, the number of sorties being flown by the very small Libyan Air Force is declining, not escalating. Some rebel leaders are asking for a no-fly zone. Others are saying, keep out of our internal affairs. There's a huge banner in the square in Benghazi saying in terms, for God's sake, don't give us any humanitarian intervention, whatever you do. The situation is that a no-fly zone, as we discovered in Iraq, is not a declaration that the country concerned must not fly its aeroplanes. Because if it does fly its aeroplanes, you have to shoot them down. And in order to shoot them down, you have to first attack their air defense systems, which are situated in the center of Tripoli and in the center of cities. By doing so, you will kill people. But let's assume that the air defense systems are attacked, the aeroplanes are shot out of the sky, and the war continues, and Gaddafi continues to win it What's next? Well, we know what's next. What's next is a Western invasion and occupation of Libya, which is precisely the opposite of what we should be fighting for. The reason the West desperately turned against Gaddafi after 10 years of treating him as a milk cow, sucking billions from the people of Libya, was they felt that this revolution was going to succeed and they should get involved because they wanted to protect their investments. BP, British Petroleum, which was stolen from the Iranian people, by the way, in the 1950s. The BP has invested $15 billion in the south of Libya and now runs the risk of losing all of it, because I don't think Libya is going to be that keen on British capitalist companies after all this is over, one way or the other. So a no-fly zone would be ineffectual, it's conceptually wrong, it's wrong in principle, and it can only lead to yet another Western involvement in an Arab and Muslim country. The best thing is for the Arab masses to come to the rescue. And I believe that that is happening and will happen. And I don't believe that Benghazi will be taken. I think Benghazi, we may well have a situation now for some years of two Libyas. People say, well, do you want to have two Libyas? I say, no, but I'd rather have two Libyas, one of which is not ruled by Gaddafi, than have one Libya that's completely ruled by Gaddafi. That's my solution. I hold the two highest civil awards in Pakistan, the Hilal-e Qaidi Azam and the Hilal-e Pakistan, both of them, for my work on the subject of Kashmir. I was for many years the secretary of the National Lobby on Kashmir in Britain. I have regularly spoken around the world, in the United States and Britain, on the subject of Kashmir, where for more than 50 years, a United Nations Security Council resolution, which promised the people of that occupied territory a plebiscite so that they could choose their national self-determination, has been denied. And 100,000 people have died in the last 20 years in the Intifada in Kashmir. 80,000, I say 100,000, but 80,000 or 100,000, it is an extraordinary level of casualties and thousands of prisoners. The use of rape as a political weapon and so on. It is the biggest occupation army in the whole world. 600,000 Indian soldiers occupy the occupied land of Kashmir. So I am, my friend, very mindful of that subject. I didn't raise it tonight because, like Iran, it's not the subject of the meeting, but I'm glad that you chose the opportunity to raise it. I think WikiLeaks was very important. I think that WikiLeaks and the Palestine Papers, which were leaked more or less at the same time, have helped to knock away the bricks of these dictatorships, not least because they undermined the confidence of these regimes when they saw what the Americans really think about them, which is not much. They didn't think much of the British either, so they are undiscriminating in their offensiveness in that regard. But I think that the separation of Sudan into North and South is very much to be regretted. I think that a big job was done on Sudan to try and undermine it and weaken it by Israel, by the West, over many years, supporting the secessionist tendencies which always existed in the South. And this job intensified when Sudan discovered that it was sitting on top of a huge ocean of oil, and worse, oil that it already sold to the People's Republic of China rather than on the international oil market priced in dollars. So I very much regret that Sudan is now two, but we have to accept it. It is there was a plebiscite, it was overwhelming, the South has now broken away, and I can only wish them well and hope that they are governed justly and democratically and that their people prosper. But in general, I'm against breaking up countries. I think in the world today, we should be seeking more and more unity amongst peoples rather than separation and separatism. It's one of the reasons why I'm against Scottish separation, and I'm standing in the Scottish Parliament elections on the 5th of May in a few weeks' time on exactly that platform. We'll see what the people's verdict is. On the subject of Bahrain, I say to the sister not to be despondent. It'll take more than 1,000 Saudi soldiers. It'll take more than 500 policemen from the UAE. I didn't know that the UAE had sent policemen. I think that's very regrettable, and that the UAE may come to regret it. But it will take more than all of that to stop the revolution in Bahrain. I think the people have decided. They have lost many martyrs. Hundreds of Bahrainis have been killed whilst the US Fifth Fleet is anchored in Bahrain. They're talking about a no-fly zone in Libya while their own fleet is in the country that's gunning down unarmed, peaceful demonstrators in the streets, including women and children killed in the dead of the night. So my hope is, and my belief is, that the people of Bahrain will continue their freedom struggle. And the more Saudi Arabia commits itself to propping up the dictatorship in Bahrain, the more quickly they will bring about the defeat and destruction of their own dictatorship, which would be, in many senses, the biggest prize of them all. The unfreest country in the world, invading another unfree country to destroy the democratic movement there, at the invitation, one assumes, of Secretary Robert Gates, who's just been visiting the country. You really couldn't make it up when relating to the land of the free and the home of the brave. On the question of Palestine, I reiterate the point that James Clark made, which is the Summer University of Palestine on the 23rd of July. You can get details at the table outside or on our website, vivapalestina.org. This will take place at the American University of Beirut, which, for those of you who know the AUB in the heart of Beirut, is a bit like being in the Sorbonne in 1968, in the middle of the great revolutionary upheaval. It will be the place to be. And it's not just for young people either. It's for the young of heart, whatever age they are. You can join the university, you can pay for the week, or you can also sleep there in the student accommodation and dormitories, excellent dormitories in the AUB, which is a very prestigious and beautiful place. The best speakers on Palestine will come from all over the world, and activists from all over the world will come to hear them speak and to debate and argue with them. And no doubt under the stars and under the leaves of the beautiful gardens at the AUB, there'll be lots of revolution in the air and music in the cafes at night. If I haven't painted an enticing enough picture, let me just tell you that I'll be there throughout. Thanks very much indeed. Salaam alaikum.
Thank you again, Mr. Galloway, for your inspiring words. And I'd like to thank everybody for coming out tonight and to remind you to please take a look at the tables that we have set up at the lobby and any contributions you can make to help us cover this event. That would be wonderful as well. Thank you and have a good night.
Thank you so much.